You're listening to The Edie J. Adler Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Shalom, amigos. Welcome to The Edie J. Adler Show. I'm Edie J. Adler, wouldn't you know that? And thank you for tuning in. Remember, I am a strong supporter of Israel, and I'm also very grateful for this beautiful nation, under God, the United States of America. We don't insult, we don't name call, no negativity here, please. If you're looking for that, this isn't the show for you. The rest of you, please stay, and thank you for tuning in. Well, this week I want to talk a little bit about myself. And I'll tell you why, because Saturday is my birthday. Yes, September 28th is my birthday. And today, the 25th, would have been the birthday of a very dear friend of mine. So happy birthday in heaven to Jeff Temkin. And the reason I wanted to talk about me a little bit, it's because I'm a walking miracle. Well, actually, I think all of us are. But in my case, I'm really, really, really a walking miracle. My parents had 7 children in total. They got married very young. They were both 18. And they had 7 children, like I said. I'm the youngest of the 7. My mom lost a baby. She was 2 years old when she died. That was before I was born. And then her last baby before me, my brother, was coming out sideways when he was being born. My mother was visiting her parents in the little town in the state of Guerrero in Mexico, Buena Vista. She had a doctor, but there was no hospital. Of course, no anesthetic or anything like that to help her. Now, my mother had given birth to all her children naturally, without anesthetic, without anything like that. But the baby coming sideways made it very, very difficult for both of them. So the doctor, without anesthetic, because there was no time to go to the city, had to go inside and turn the baby around. My mother lost a lot of blood. My brother was born purple, not breathing. Thank God they revived him. And my mother was told not to have any more children. She was told that this was too hard on her body and she couldn't have any more children. So fast forward 14 years later, and here I am. Now, this was all in Mexico, and abortion in Mexico at this time was illegal. But 2 of my mother's doctors, 2 specialists, advised her to end the pregnancy. They told her that the baby wouldn't survive and that the pregnancy would kill her, more than likely. So my parents took about 1 second to think about it. And they thought, what does the Torah says? The Torah says, choose life. So they decided to put everything in God's hands. Now, according to the Torah, my mother was allowed to end the pregnancy because her life was in danger. But her faith and my father's faith was greater than the fear of losing her life and leaving her children and her husband. So they put it in God's hands. And at 26 weeks into the pregnancy, here I am. I was extremely premature. I measured about 10 inches and I weighed less than 2 pounds. When I was born, all they did for me was put me in an incubator. No special feeding, no special treatments, just put me in an incubator. My mother had a briefcase, not a briefcase, a suitcase full of baby clothes flown to her. And because this was all in Santa Barbara, and they were vacationing. And the nurse was helping my mother with the unpack with the baby clothes. And she was looking at the baby clothes and going, "Oh, how pretty. Oh, how precious. Oh, look at the little dress. Oh, it's a shame she'll never get to wear it." So my mother was upset and told her, "Why won't she wear it? She's going to grow into it." So about 6 weeks later, without any expectations on the part of my doctors for me to make it, they sent me home. They told my mother to keep me warm and comfortable and to prepare for the worst, that I probably wouldn't make it through the night that day. Well, keep me warm she did. For the next few weeks, she didn't sleep. She kept me in her arms at night. And if she needed to turn, she would turn and turn me this way. And then the whole night was like that. She wrapped me in a little fur coat that she had. And she kept me warm. Now here I am, about to celebrate another birthday on Saturday. All thanks to my parents' loving, wonderful care, Neftali and Eron Ocampo. Those are my beautiful parents. That picture was taken in 2001. And also wanted to share with you, that's one of the reasons I am against abortion. Because babies are being aborted now younger than I was. And I made it. So I'm not going to try to change your mind if you're for abortion. I'm just going to tell you, it's a baby. It's a life. And like my father explained to me, because I asked them, my dad and I talked about everything. And I asked them, "Daddy, if the soul doesn't enter the body until the first breath," because that's what Jews believe, that the soul enters the body with the first breath, like God gave life to the first human by breathing life into him. And my dad said, because that body has been assigned to a soul. A soul is waiting to be born. And if you stop that pregnancy, if you don't give that soul a chance to live, that's why. So unless the mother's life is in danger, incest, rape. But even in those cases, I would hope that you would consider giving the baby up for adoption, because there are many people who would love to have a baby and they can't. If you're considering an abortion, just take a couple of days. Don't do it just now. Please just take a couple of days and think about your decision and think about me. It would have been totally, totally justified to not let me be born. But look at me. I'm healthy. I have lived a good life. I'm happy. I have a good, great husband. I have good siblings. Only four of us are left of the seven. And I took care of my parents when they suffered from Alzheimer's. That's not why they had me, because nobody knew that they were going to get Alzheimer's later in life. But I was glad and blessed to be able to take care of them when they needed me, like they took care of me when I needed them. So that's part of my story. Some other time I will tell you more, because my beginning was full of drama, including somebody trying to steal me from the incubator, but that's a story for another day. Right now, I would like to welcome my guest, a renowned pediatrician and a dear friend of ours, Dr. Ben Keshberg. I'm hoping I'm not chopping up your last name, Ben. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Edie. I don't know how renowned I am, but happy birthday.
It's
an honor to talk to a miracle, a living miracle.
Thank you. It's an honor to talk to you. So, Ben, you're a pediatrician. Why don't you explain to our listeners, our viewers, according to science, what were my chances and where were not only to live, but to be, quote unquote, normal and live a normal life?
Well, I'm a relatively new pediatrician. I did my medical school and residency in the 2000s, finishing in 2010. And I had a previous career in computers and programming. And so by that time, 24 weeks was actually considered to be viable, what they call viable, whereas if a baby's born premature at 24 weeks, then medical science can allow that child to live and in most cases, a normal life. But, you know, at the time that you were born, that science wasn't available. Now at 26 weeks, you are pretty much everything is there, but your lungs are not fully developed. Your GI tract, you know, you may not be fully ready to feed in the normal way, and usually IV fluids, NG fluids, nasal gastric, other ways to get nutrition are used in order to have a premature baby grow. So that technology wasn't really there at the time you were born. And so it's really pretty amazing that you were born at 26 weeks and then sent home at 32 weeks. Now at 32 weeks, it's really feeding, what we call feeding and growing, where as long as you can keep getting calories, then, you know, you are pretty much fully developed. And a mother's love and a mother's instinct is really what you need. So kudos to your mom for doing, going against all the naysayers and doing what was best for you. And, you know, doctors don't know everything. Doctors are wrong sometimes, and you know, especially the last 4 years, I think we've discovered that they are often wrong. And so it doesn't surprise me that you were able to survive, given that your mom took over.
Thank you. And one thing that my father used to tell me, that when I was born, my mother wasn't even taken to the OR or the delivery room because they didn't think she was going to have the baby right away. So she had me in the room, in the hospital, but in the room. And so when I was born, the nurse handed me to my dad. And my dad said that he freaked out because it felt like jello. It felt like I was going to go through his fingers. I'm guessing maybe that's normal for any newborn, but is that something that it was because I was so tiny? So
I think it was because of the size. Yeah. So I don't really work in the hospital. I work outpatient, and sometimes I'll see a 1 or 2 day old that is maybe 34, 35 weeks. And, you know, even at that age, they are pretty small. So at 26 weeks, very, very small, probably a couple of pounds, maybe even less than that. So very, very small. And so probably smaller than the size of a kitten when a kitten's born.
Yeah, less than 2 pounds, a little under two. I think it was 800 grams. And
so I you know, even at 34, 35 weeks, they seem very fragile to me. So, and I'm very cautious, of course, but I can understand your father feeling that way.
Yeah. So enough about me now. Let's talk about you. You have a fascinating career life. Like you said, you were into computers, which only affirms your intelligence, how smart you are. So why did you change? What made you go into medicine and specifically to take care of little children?
Well, I was good at computers. It was something I kind of fell into. My brother offered me a job to help me pay my way through college. I was doing math, computer science. I love math. I love numbers. I love problem solving. But at a certain level, when you get to a certain level in mathematics, it becomes very theoretical, and deltas and epsilons, and it was over my head. And I knew that I wasn't going to go any farther in mathematics. So I ended up staying in programming, and just, you know, it kind of paid the bills. And eventually I did make a pretty good living at it. I was good at it, but I wasn't passionate about it. And I started doing some volunteering, like recordings for the blind and dyslexic, donating my platelets, things like that. And my dad was a very altruistic person, and he kind of gave me a kick in the butt, and other people too that had an influence on me. My little brother, who was in the military trying to save his marriage and everything, and he tried to get into medical school, even though he wasn't much of a, his science wasn't his strength. And, but yet he tried, it didn't work out for him. He ended up going into finance, which was better suited to him, but it just put the idea in my head. Hey, he is trying to change his career and go into medicine. Why can't I do that? And then I dated somebody who was applying to medical school, and, that relationship didn't work out, but again, it put the thought in my head. I was thinking about it at that time I thought about going to be a math teacher, and then, medicine. So those were my two choices, but I thought, based on my personality, I'm kind of more calm and introverted, that working with people one-on-one, one-on-two, one-on-three in pediatrics would be easier for me than one-on-30 or 25 in a math class. I knew it was going to be 10 years going down the road if I changed my career. You know, I had to go back to do pre-med, which I did at Santa Monica College, a great school, by the way. I think I got a better education there than at UCLA. And then, you know, 4 years of medical school, Sackler School of Medicine in Tel Aviv, Israel, and then my residency at CHLA, Children's Hospital, Los Angeles. So I knew that once I started down that path, it was going to be 10 years. So I sat on the fence for 4 years, and finally I made the decision to go into medicine. And it did take 10 years, but very happy I did. So I got into medical school. I started at 34, was 37 when I went into medical school, and I wasn't the oldest medical student. I was in my class, but I encountered other medical students that were older. There were a lot that were sort of had done other things for a few years, a lot in their late 20s or early 30s. And then 44 by the time I finished residency. So it was a challenge. Definitely there's a reason why people go to medical school right after college, because you have the stamina, you have the energy. I did not have that. And, you know, my colleagues helped me out. You know, there were all-nighters at CHLA, and, you know, you're just kind of delirious trying to put two words together. And, you know, of course, the nurses run the hospitals anyway. You know, they're the ones who really do all the work and really taking care of patients. So there's all, and you have attending physicians and so on. So there's a good support system when you're a resident. But I got a great education there, and so, yeah, I've been doing pediatrics now for about 14 years, and I enjoy it. It's stressful at times. I see a lot of patients, but it's rewarding. You know, I'm not saving lives in the sense of I don't work in the ER. I'm not in the hospital. I'm a kind of an outpatient. I'm an outpatient pediatrician, and so a lot of well exams, well babies, and then acute visits, asthma, infection, injuries, things like that. So and I do some urgent care too. Mostly everybody's healthy, and I just have to have my radar up. I got good training in medical school and residency. So, and I've developed clinical skills to where, I can pick up things. I'm pretty good at my sense of perception. So reading the room, reading the parents when I walk into the room, and even just walking into the room, knowing, is this a sick patient or not? I mean, in terms of, is this someone who needs a workup, someone who needs to go to the ER, someone who needs to be hospitalized. So you develop those skills over time, and it's rewarding. I mean, people are very appreciative, and even though I'm not necessarily saving lives, in the end, I'm providing a good service for my patients, and they appreciate me.
Yeah. Why pediatrics? So, of all the specialties, why not cardiology I don't know, geriatric, go the other way. Why pediatrics?
Well, I have lots of nieces and nephews. I didn't end up having kids of my own. I'm happily married a second time, and, we don't have kids. We're probably not going to. But I have a lot of nieces and nephews and always related well with them. I think I have a childlike disposition. I like to joke around with kids, and in fact, that's my way of sort of dealing with the monotony of every job has monotony. And, you see a thousand ear infections, it can be monotonous, but joking with the patients, telling jokes, and, I think they can sense my calmness, and they feel more comfortable around me. I think kids are, it's an optimistic profession. I couldn't handle geriatrics, and I give kudos, and I admire those doctors who can do that. Adult medicine actually to me is a little bit more depressing, because adults are usually sicker, lots of medications, and chronic disease. I mean, we're starting to see that in kids too, but most kids generally are not on a bunch of medications, and generally speaking, outside of the obesity, which I'm, trying to help work on, generally kids get better, they're resilient. And so it's a very positive, uplifting profession. And then lastly, I was kind of paying attention during my rotations in medical school, because I wasn't convinced on pediatrics, I was leaning towards it, but which doctors, how they treated the nurses, the medical students, the patients, and so on. And pediatricians by far were the nicest, the least stressed out, and treated everybody well. And so I took that to heart as well. And so once I had my pediatric rotation at Schneider's in Israel, I was pretty much convinced that that's where I was going.
Very nice. Yeah, I got very lucky with my parents, because she wasn't necessary. She was a general practitioner, a very dear friend of mine, Aliza Lifshitz. She took care of my parents, and she sent them to the different specialists. But she was the one that was really overseeing everything. And she was fantastic. She was at Cedars-Sinai, another Mexican Jew like me, and she treated my parents like they were her family. Unfortunately, we lost her a few years ago to cancer. But I got very lucky with her, because my parents, they were very strong, and they exercised every day. But when they got older, they started getting all kinds of problems, and then finally Alzheimer's. But having Aliza as their doctor was a blessing. So yeah, what you say about working with children, that makes a lot of sense. I love children. I couldn't have any, but I love children. And if I had any, you'd be their doctor.
Oh, well, thank you.
You have such a nice, calming personality. I, as you know, I suffer from anxiety. And when I was dealing with some health issues, even though you're specialized in children, I took the liberty of sometimes coming to you for advice, and just talking to you made me feel better, always, always. You're so, so kind and so centered. Whatever I was feeling, whatever fear I had, sometimes I didn't want to talk to you because I didn't want to bother you, but talking to you always, always made me feel better, and that's just your personality, and I'm glad that you decided to go into medicine, and I'm glad for all the children that you've treated that you went into pediatrics, because I'm sure that you're so kind that you think everybody else is like you, but not everybody. Not everybody has the patience. Not everybody has the bedside manner. And not everybody has the kindness and the empathy to treat children, especially when children are going to the doctor, they get scared because they don't know what's going to happen. They get a shot or whatever, and they get scared. And I'm sure that with you, it's different. I'm sure that you reassure them, and they're not as afraid of you as I was of my doctor when I was little.
Well, thank you. I do what I can to try to minimize the anxiety when I walk into the room. I try to sit down as soon as I can because I am relatively tall. I'm not super tall. I'm just under 6 foot, but compared to a four-year-old, I'm tall.
Yes.
I always try to start with chit chat and not, you know, and I never use the S word in the room. Never use the S word, S-H-O-T.
Yes.
I never use the F word, you know, F-A-T. Sometimes parents will use it, but I don't like that word. And we talk about more in a scientific way, the weight growing faster than the height type of thing. But I try to have young toddlers in the parents' lap when I examine them. It's easier because they're afraid of the bench and they don't want to be laying down on the bench. It scares them. And so little things and the joke telling, as I mentioned, just kind of helps, distract them until the visit's over. So,
right. That's very good. Before we continue, do you and Laura have any pets?
We do. We have a cat, Rascal, and we had her sister. We had to put down a couple of years ago, but Rascal's 17 years old. She has chronic kidney disease at stage 3 now. We have to give her fluids once a week, in subcutaneous fluids. I never thought I'd be giving fluids to a cat, but she's tough. She's resilient. She's very affectionate. She's got a really good spirit, and she loves to lay in my crook at night, and she likes chin rubs. She's kind of like a dog almost in that sense. And
I had a cat that I had to do fluids to also. And he also had cancer, and it was the hardest thing for me to do that, to put the fluids into him. But had to be done, and I did it. And the reason I asked you about pets is because every week we feature a pet who is looking for a home. Now, let me tell you something, my dear friends. If you've seen the show at least once, you know how I feel about people who return pets to the shelter. There's a difference between ignorance and sheer indifference and apathy, no matter how you look at it. This is a very sweet dog, and she has been disgracefully failed by everyone. Bella is only 7 pounds. She's been thrashed, but she's still beautiful Maltese mix. And even though she's 10 years old, she's still on spayed. She's on blue alert at the East Valley Animal Shelter, which is a high-kill shelter in Los Angeles. This is the second time that she has been owner dumped. Come on, people. Where's your heart? Bella was a medical owner surrender back in January and was quickly adopted. The shelter counseled the adopter about spaying her and to see the vet about Bella's unusual bruising on the neck and shoulders. Her grade 5-6 systolic heart murmur and her moderate dental disease. The adopter was supposed to have everything checked out and return proof of veterinary care by February. I'm really surprised that the shelter let her go without having these issues looked out. So instead, friendly Bella is back at the shelter and practically unrecognizable from the beautiful dog who left 8 months ago. Her dental disease has progressed to severe periodontal disease. Bella has a thinning coat, hardly any hair left in some areas, and has lost weight. She still has the heart murmur. The notes say that she might still have or has developed new bruising on the neck and shoulders. On top of endocrinology disorders, Bella should be worked up to check her platelets and for clotting disorders. I know this all sounds like too much, but aren't all our beloved seniors worthy of compassion and love? When I say Bella has not only been failed, I mean it. She has been betrayed by everybody, including the shelter. The adopter's daughter stated that her parents were going into a nursing home, and that's why she had to give up Bella. I'm sorry for them. That's too bad. But please, people, do not adopt if you can't or won't take good and responsible guardianship of the animal for the rest of his or her life. And if you are an older citizen and you're not in good health, don't adopt a dog or a cat that needs special care. Don't do that. Don't be selfish, okay? I know they're good companions. I know they bring lots of joy and love. But if you think you're not going to be able to take care of them, don't be selfish and please get a teddy bear. With that said, let's go back to someone who is obviously not abandoning their beloved cat, my dear friend Ben, Dr. Ben. Let's go back to you, my dear friend. So when you were in your internship, do you remember any difficult cases that you handled, anything that maybe you even prayed for guidance?
To be honest, I wasn't as religious back then. I've become more religious in the last 9 years or so. So I wasn't doing a lot of praying. Children's Hospital, Los Angeles, I mean, they send the sickest of the sick go there. And I do remember one rotation in the PICU, the pediatric intensive care unit. I mean, that's where the hardest cases go. And it's sort of where the kids go either they get better and they go home, or they pass away. And I remember one 4-week rotation, 8 of our patients passed away. And that was really hard. 4 of them were my patients, or at least I was assigned to them. And I mean, there was nothing that could be done for these patients. And some of them born with like congenital kidney issues. And there was a 7-year-old, I think, that had a spontaneous brain bleed, and you know, there were really, really hard cases. And I think I was impressed with the nurses in the PICU who just handled each situation, each death with dignity, and the way they treated the family. And I think as a medical student, I think there was one case that really hit me. I remember as an Armenian family that the mom unfortunately didn't, the baby had a fever, a newborn is considered to be an emergency because they don't have a mature immune system, and the infection can cross the blood-brain barrier. You can get meningitis, and the newborn can die very quickly. So I remember I was a fourth year medical student doing a rotation, and the mom didn't want to do the lumbar puncture, and she waited, and she refused it initially, and then 24 hours later she did do it. And the baby ended up having bacterial meningitis, and I remember the parents coming to me, telling me, they were calling me doctor. I was not a doctor yet, and they were calling me, doctor, what should we do, doctor? Can you help us, doctor? Help our baby, doctor. And I kind of stepped back because I wasn't ready for that responsibility. And unfortunately, that baby ended up passing away. And that's kind of when it hit me, like, wow, I'm really heading into a job of major responsibility. And, I really have to focus and do the best I can. And so that really struck me, that patient. I'll always remember that. And
what about on the other side, a case that might have appeared very difficult, very challenging, and then the kid got better and survived? Do you remember any like that?
So, I think in off the top of my head, there are definitely cases. I know there. I remember in medical school in Israel, there was a case where a baby was born that looked like the face was deformed, and the doctor was just very sharp and did some kind of nasal maneuver, and. The next day or the 2 days later, the patient's swelling went down, and the baby's head looked normal, not malformed. And to me, it seemed like a miracle. Off the top of my head, I'm having a hard time thinking of other examples.
That's a good one.
Yes.
So, like you mentioned, you've become religious. We're not fanatic. We're not, but we are observant Jews. These difficult times that we're living through, has it affected you, not just personally, but professionally? Has it affected you being Jewish and the whole world seeming to be against Israel right now?
Obviously, it's affected me personally. Professionally, a little bit. I've decided to, until the war is over and all the hostages are back, I wear an Israeli flag tie clasp. And pretty much I've worn it just about every day that I wear a tie. Most people don't say anything. I've had a few positive comments, but there was one Muslim parent. I had seen this child once before, just coming in for a checkup. This was the second time I was seeing them. The baby's first name, I won't say the last name, of course, the baby's first name was Musa, which I learned means Moses or Moshe in Hebrew. In Arabic, and I thought that was beautiful. Like, they, Muslim families name their kids after characters in the Hebrew Bible. But at the end of the visit, she looks at my tie clasp and she says, you know, I really liked you, but I see that you stand with Israel. And, you know, I don't think I'm going to bring my child to see you again. And I said, well, that's too bad. And, you know, I'm able to walk and chew gum at the same time. I can be, you know, for Palestinian rights and for, you know, eventually a Palestinian state, should there actually be someone, you know, Palestinians that can be negotiated with that are not terrorists. And, you know, Israel has a right to defend itself.
Absolutely.
And, so anyway, I said that the IDF doesn't target civilians, that the Hamas hides amongst civilians. And, you know, and so I had mentioned about all the Israelis that were killed. And she said, well, what about all the Palestinians that were killed? And so we were talking about that. And then she, at the end, she said, the IDF does target civilians. You need to get new news sources. And then I walked out of the room. So I haven't seen her again with her child. But overall, I think I've had positive responses, usually from Christians. Christians will see my Israeli tie clasp. And most of the support I think I've gotten have been from Christians. They've been very positive. I was fortunate, Laura and I were fortunate enough, my wife Laura, to see Douglas Murray Monday night at the Wiltern. And he's just been such a strong supporter of Israel and Jews. And it's amazing how it's non-Jews who are the biggest supporters of Israel right now. Although I think our fellow Jews are waking up.
I hope so. I really hope so. Because even if you're not religious, you have a Jewish name, they're coming for you, my friends. Wake up. Sorry.
Yeah, Israel is on the battlefront, the front lines for Western civilization.
I agree.
They're the ones that are, yeah.
We're the only thing standing between the terrorists and the rest of the world, unfortunately.
Exactly.
Well, I'm sorry that happened to you, but it's her loss. She lost a good doctor. And if she's going to let hatred be ahead of her child's welfare, then that's too bad for the child. And she's also teaching hatred to that child. And that's a shame. That really is a shame.
It is. It's, you know, but we see in indoctrination in our schools too, and in the universities, it's amazing. These Douglas Murray used the word ignorant and narcissistic, and these ignorant narcissistic people's students, college students who are chanting from the river to the sea, they have no idea what their moral compass is broken. They're just expressing feeling, emotion, and they are not thinking clearly. And I don't know how to break that circuit to where they can, you know, stop thinking emotionally and think rationally. You know, that's what we have to do, is wake these kids up. And it's not entirely their fault. Their parents haven't taught them the right values, and the instruction that they've had has been, brainwashing them. And to us, it's obvious, you know, who's decent, who's indecent in this war that Israel's fighting against Hamas, the evil terrorists. And it's so obvious to anybody who can think clearly, but so many people are blinded.
Exactly. Like Prime Minister Netanyahu calls them useful idiots.
They are. And, I feel sad because they don't realize they're useful idiots. And you know, they've been taken advantage of to some extent. It's not entirely their fault. So we have to somehow wake them up and keep telling facts about Israel and pushing the real story.
Absolutely. And going back to your specialty, what is your best your best advice for parents, especially new parents, people who just had a baby or people who had their first child? What is your best advice for that child so that they, what do they need to look for, make sure that she or he is always healthy? And what is your advice?
Well, I don't know if there's one thing in particular. I think new parents have the hardest job because there's so much, it's overwhelming. It doesn't matter how many books you read on parenting, you're never fully prepared. I think if I was to ever have a child, it would be overwhelming for me too. There's just so much to learn. I think I try to relax them about, you know, everything doesn't have to follow exactly. You don't have to have them on a set schedule of feeding every 2 hours. You know, we do worry the first week of life. We want to make sure. A lot of times it takes a while for breast milk to come in, and you know, a newborn can lose weight the first week of life. They can lose a lot of weight, so we want to make sure that doesn't happen. But once they get past the first week, you know, it's usually pretty smooth sailing, and Mother Nature kind of takes over, and mom takes over, and you know, maternal instincts kick in. And so I think I try to calm them. I remember a couple that are same sex couple, two women who had a baby, and they were so freaking out about it, and they had lots of questions, and they didn't, later on, they seemed like they told me after the fact that I wasn't taking their concerns seriously, but in reality, they thanked me for just kind of calming them down. And because in the end, everything worked out, and it wasn't that I wasn't taking it seriously. It's just that, you know, newborn parents are like that. Yeah. They just have, everything seems to be an emergency or unknown. And so anyway, that's sort of my general answer to your question.
Can sudden death syndrome be prevented?
Well, I'm not 100% expert on it, but, you know, back sleeping is the safest position, sleeping on the back. And, you know, definitely to my knowledge, studies show that side sleeping is a 7 times increased risk, and tummy sleeping is a 20 times increased risk. So having a child, newborn, sleep on their back as much as possible. You know, again, parents don't have to monitor 24/7, but if they find that their child's sleeping on their side or their tummy, to try to put them on their back. And the risk starts to go away once they're rolling both ways. The problem is usually a breathing issue where they're kind of trapped in a position where they're not breathing. Uh-huh. So, you know, certainly you don't want to have lots of pillows and stuff on the crib, and you know, stuffed animals and things like that, where if they roll one way and they get trapped against a stuffed animal, they can have problems with breathing, and then they can't roll back. So that's, you know, really the first 6 months, making sure that there's not much in the bed, and then once they're rolling both ways, then the risk really goes down quite a bit.
Oh, that's good to know. I didn't know that. Well, Ben, we're coming to the end of the show. Anything else that you would like to add?
Well, I would like to say that it's been a pleasure to talk to you, and thank you for having me on. I would say that, as I mentioned, it's the last 9 years or so that I've been religious. I really didn't know much about the Torah 9 years ago, and I, you know, through regular Shabbat attendance and through regular Torah study, I have gotten a better knowledge. And and actually, through when I went back to medical school to pre-med and taking biology, that's when I really started, my belief in God got stronger through science. A lot of people think, oh, religious people are anti-science, irrational. It's totally the opposite. I'm very rational, I'm very scientific, very logical. And, you know, how something so complicated in the cell as, you know, the nucleus with the DNA, and how that evolved out of nothing is, it's just impossible, statistically impossible. Actually, if you read Stephen Meyer's books, Signature in the Cell, Darwin's Doubt, you know, sort of mathematical evidence that there's just hasn't been enough time in the universe for it to have been created out of nothing, and or even just a simple protein to be created out of amino acids. So so anyway, I basically came to a stronger belief in God through science and
I've heard that
through
before.
Logic.
I've heard that from other doctors, as a matter of fact, that when they study the system and everything that goes in the body, it works like a computer, they realize that somebody had to make it. Somebody had to make it happen.
Yeah, and people point to, oh, well, look at the monkeys. They have, you know, 98% of our DNA, and, you know, how that obviously evolution explains everything. And there's so many holes in evolution, and, it, and you know, evolution kind of, Darwin's theories explain microevolution, minor changes, but the fact that we're, DNA is so close to a monkey's and yet we are so different. There's an operating system, you know, what we used to thought was junk DNA that we don't fully understand, and that's different on us than it is for monkeys. And so there's still a lot that we have to learn, and that'll be never ending.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Ben, for joining us. Thank you. I appreciate your knowledge and sharing your knowledge with us. And it's a pleasure having you. Please give my love to your beautiful, beautiful wife. And I will see you soon.
Hey. Thank you, Edie. Happy birthday.
Say hi
to Neil, and I'll see you Saturday.
Thank you. My dear friends, thank you for tuning in to the EDJ Adler Show. Next week, I won't be here because it's Rosh Hashanah. And like I said, I'm an observant Jew, so I'll be at temple. Thank you for watching. I'm EDJ Adler. Remember to always, always be grateful.
You're listening to The EDJ Adler Show, only on LA Talk Radio.